We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at some findings from the surprising science of child development. Our guests are two University of Illinois faculty members, Laura Kramer and Philip Rodkin, and journalist Ashley Merriman. Ashley Merriman, together with Poe Bronson, wrote about their research in the book Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, and in a series of reports for Newsweek magazine. The premise of the book Nurture Shock, as stated by the authors, is this. Many of our strategies for nurturing children are backfiring because key twists in the science of children have been overlooked. The authors say what we think we know is wrong. The U of I's Laura Kramer and Philip Rodkin are among those who are responsible for changing our understanding of children. Laura Kramer is an associate dean of academic programs and professor of applied family studies at the U of I. Philip Rodkin is an associate professor and child development chair in the child development of the College of Education at the University of Illinois. Ashley Merriman is joining us by phone this afternoon. She's a writer and an attorney living in Los Angeles, where she runs a church-based tutoring program for inner-city children. Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, is published by 12 Books. And listeners, I hope you'll join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Kramer, Dr. Rodkin, Ashley Merriman, welcome. So good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me back. I'm so excited to keep this conversation going.
Wonderful. Ashley, when it comes to thinking about children and what we think we know about them, what would you say are our most basic errors?
Well, I think fundamentally that we often approach kids the same way we react to something. I mean, I think if you ask someone, you know, does that five-year-old's brain operate the same way yours does, you would say no, but we use ourselves as a reference point in many different ways. We talked before when I was on about how the effect of praise and rewards on kids is different than how they are with us. And I think the same goes for so many things in terms of, you know, how much sleep we need. The fact that you and I are often tired at work, we go, well, that must be okay for kids, but the research is showing that there's dramatic differences in how sleep affects kids cognitively, metabolically, in ways that it just doesn't affect adults. The other kind of mistake that I think we often make is this sort of either-or mentality, what we sort of think of as the good-bad dichotomy. Things are either good for kids or they're bad for kids. And that really doesn't seem to be the case. Quite often, they're both. Jamie Ostroff, a researcher at the University of Buffalo, has looked at educational TV, and he's actually found that kids who watch a lot of educational TV, more than, say, Power Rangers, are actually more relationally aggressive. They're more likely to smack a kid or say something hurtful, and I don't want to play with you, you're not my friend. That kind of behavior, they also learn it's nice to hug and be friends and invite people to parties, but the educational television shows both behaviors. So it's not that we only learn good things from Arthur. We learn the good and the bad. So that's the other thing where I really think we make a mistake. We go, oh, well, that's good for kids. We can do that. And then that's bad for kids. And we write things off and don't look at sort of a more fine perspective. And I think once we also start having that kind of good-bad dichotomy, we lose the science. You know, and I know that Lori and Phila have a lot to say about this, but once you start taking these sort of absolute good, bad, then you've just taken the science and the understanding that they bring really out of the equation.
So how do we go about sorting out the bad from the good? Lori?
Well, I think that the study of children's sibling relationships has a lot to inform us about this, because that's a classic example. You know, we'd like to think that young children get along well with their sisters and brothers, and that relationships can be thought of as good relationships. But the reality is that a lot of those good times do happen. A lot of those very positive pro-social behaviors do happen between siblings. But in the next second, you may also see a whole host of very negative, antagonistic, conflictual types of interactions as well. And that's really led researchers to think about these relationships as ambivalent relationships, meaning that they're really mixtures of the positive and negative, and that we expect to see some rapid fluctuations of those behaviors. Our goal is to try to make children interact more pro-socially, a lot more than antagonistically, because we know that that's going to have some benefits for them. But it's also important to point out that some of those negative interactions actually have some important developmental significance for children, too. So it's important to see both sides.
Phil, do you see that ambivalence in your work?
Well, sure. I mean, child development is one of the only sciences or social sciences where good and bad is hard to hard to extricate. What we think is good, what parents think is good or bad, regardless even of the time scale, something that could be good in the short term, negative in the long term, as part of the concepts of the science. So when you do research, you're not really supposed to consider in your analysis what seems desirable, what seems undesirable. You're supposed to put the facts together as you see the data having, you know, what they say. But yet, you know, we live in a society, in every society, where we want our kids to do better, whatever better may mean for different people. So it's difficult to put out findings or to try and interpret findings that don't fit this sort of good to good, one good thing leads to another good thing, one bad thing leads to another bad thing, or interpreting findings in the immediate context of does this seem to be a good thing or a bad thing. So one positive aspect among many of Ashley and Poe's book is that they try and look at the research literature as it stands to synthesize it and to put their own angle on it in a way that doesn't necessarily fit, you know, this one good thing leads to another good thing kind of thinking.
Mm. Ashley, in an interview on a blog, I found this. You say one of the most surprising things for you as a result of this project of Nurture Shock, the book and the columns that you wrote with Poe Bronson for Newsweek magazine, is that it's become more fun for you to be around kids as a result of what you've learned, because you see them as more interesting. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I confess that that's true. I enjoy kids a lot more now than I did before. I mean, I've been tutoring almost 800 kids for about 11 years, and I, you know, feel very, you know, it's important to help them. You know, but did I always enjoy watching that kid do a meltdown or say, I can't do my homework and throw it in frustration? No. But now I feel like researchers like Lori and Phil have handed me this sort of magic decoder ring. And now I look and I'm like, okay, well, what happened? What particular thing set off that meltdown? What do they think they're achieving when they, you know, insult their sibling or their best friend? And, you know, there's suddenly a what's going on is sort of aggressive behavior, and why did we trigger it? And it was actually really funny. My tutoring kids know that I'm doing this stuff about child development, but we don't really go into it. And one of the reasons that happened is because I was doing research on why kids lie. And one of my six-year-olds, we were walking across the parking lot, and she said, what are you doing? And that's what I told her. I'm like, I'm finding out about why little kids lie. And she looked at me. And I mean, there was nothing in what she had done that indicated there was anything about this in her. There was no lying. We were walking across the parking lot. But she looked at me and she goes, hee, 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 and she started giggling and she ran away. And it was like she realized that I had caught her in something, and there was no catching. I was just telling her what I did. So, I mean, it's really fun. I apologize to the people who I sit next to on airplanes because, you know, before you go, oh, please don't sit me in front of the crying child. And now I spend the whole time doing language experiments that I've learned from Cornell, and can I actually get the toddler to learn a new vocabulary word?
Well, one of the things that I really want to delve into now is a conflict in children, because both of our guests here with me in the studio work on this. Dr. Kramer alluded to her work with sibling conflict. And in Nurture Shock, readers will be introduced to Dr. Kramer this way. Dr. Lori Kramer, Associate Dean at the University of Illinois, is attempting to do the impossible, get brothers and sisters to be nicer to one another. Lori Kramer, would you tell us about your program for children, More Fun with Sisters and Brothers?
Yeah, this is a program that we have been working on for about 13, 14 years, and it really comes as a result from some longitudinal research and other studies that I've done that really try to identify what is important, what are the essential ingredients in children's sibling relationships, what can we learn about what's important in these relationships, and can we teach children some of these important competencies so that they can enjoy the benefits of good relationships. So I'm happy to say that we have been able to identify about 6 essential competencies, and we're focusing on children right now between the ages of 4 and 8. Our previous work focused on 4 to 6-year-olds who had infant and toddler-age siblings were kind of moving up developmentally. But we've identified some of the core things that really predict better sibling relationships in the long run. And they are things that we can actually teach, which I think is just remarkable. We don't have to assume that just because the relationship starts out on rocky ground that it's going to continue that way. So some of the things that we focus on in our program is basically giving kids the idea that we want them to have a fun relationship with one another, to like each other. That's why we call it Fun with Sisters and Brothers. We teach them how to invite each other to play. You know, it's not just an obvious thing to a young child. And we teach them what to do when they don't want to play. How can you decline an invitation to play in a way that won't lead to hurt feelings or to conflict? We also teach kids some basic skills in perspective taking, how to look at a situation not only in terms of what you want or what you need, but to start to realize that your brother or sister may have their own unique set of needs and wants and interests and preferences, and that those can be just as valid as yours. We also try to tackle some difficult concepts with kids. The fact that these relationships with sisters and brothers can be very emotional, they can be very frustrating. And so we work with kids to try to help them develop a vocabulary for talking about those emotions. And then we give them some skills that they can use to try to manage some of those unpleasant emotions and affects in the course of their interaction with a sibling. And then finally, we work on conflict management. We think about conflicts between siblings as problems, and problems have solutions. So we give kids some very basic skills in how to address those conflicts. We work really hard to educate parents around these issues, too, so that they can support children's learning of these skills in the home.
Can you give us an idea of how you try to diffuse a situation, get that emotion under control, or back, you know, take a step back?
Absolutely. We borrowed this technique from some other remarkable people in the field who've worked with peer relations, but basically we teach a very simple self-control strategy to children. 3 simple steps, and they learn this the first hour that they're with us. Stop, think, and talk. Very basic. But if you can teach children to stop when they're in a situation like that, it gives them the opportunity to see what's going on around them and to prepare themselves to think about what their goals are for that situation, what they want to have happen, how they can make that happen. And then finally, we're teaching kids to talk, to communicate with one another so that they can start some dialogue. So those are the basic skills, and we build upon those in each session to really complement the competencies that we're working on. But it's just remarkable after 45 minutes to hear kids be able to tell you, stop, think, and talk. And very quickly, they're able to apply this in other situations as well.
You know, Dr. Philip Rodkin, your work also involves conflict among children, and in particular in classroom settings, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your work and how that setting affects conflict in children.
So our work, I think, has been focused mainly in the schools. And so myself, my doctoral students, Ramin Karimpour, Travis Wilson, Heijong An, we and our team have a study in a number of local schools here in the area and in some other places where we're focusing on how children are relating to one another in classrooms, first grade, third grade, fifth grade, and in particular what the social networks are between kids, who's friends with whom, which kids dislike one another, who are the most popular kids, who are the most unpopular kids, trying really in every classroom to generate essentially a map of the social relationships between children with an eye towards who's on top and who's on bottom, mm-hmm. and who's in the middle with regards to popularity, social status, which for us is a proxy for social influence. Which kids are the ones who other children listen to? Which are the kids who seem to set the tone, whether aggressive or pro-social or something else in a classroom? And also the networks that children form. The friendships, as I mentioned earlier, the peer groups. You know, who are kids hanging out with? Because many times what seems to be the influences that kids pay attention to most is not the whole class or the school as a whole, but their peer group, the children who they're interacting with most often. You know, and oftentimes as well, those peer groups are segregated, you know, certainly on the basis of gender, boys and girls, sometimes on the basis of ethnicity as well. So this study that we're working on now is looking at classrooms as a social map, as a social network, how kids are fitting in or not fitting into that social network. And we're also watching teachers quite carefully using a system that was developed by Bob Pianta at the University of Virginia, the classroom observation system that's used in many, many other contexts, Head Start contexts in particular, to see what kind of emotional support, instructional support, how teachers are interacting with kids. And what we're interested in this study are the kinds of behaviors that teachers make, the kinds of actions they take, the attitudes they have, their beliefs and understandings about how kids do or should get along with one another. And to see, well, what is it that teachers are doing that influences not just one kid or another kid or a third child, but the classroom as a whole, mm-hmm. whether that social atmosphere in the mm-hmm. class is bonkers, or is it working, you know, towards learning, you know? And then, of course, what can you do? You know, what is it that teachers are doing that seem most effective in channeling the best out of the community of kids in a classroom? And so of course, we're also looking at achievement, children's test scores, aggression, bullying, school relatedness, how kids feel about the educational process. And that's been the most important work, I think, that we've done lately over the last couple of years. How can teachers affect the social mm-hmm. atmosphere in the class? And does the social atmosphere, in turn, produce better outcomes for children? You know, a problem in, you know, education for many, many years, and it was pointed out by a famous sociologist, James Coleman, over 50 years ago, is that the values that adults have in building schools, elementary schools, Coleman was speaking of high schools in particular. You know, the reasons why we build these things, for better or for worse, and the values that we try and impart to kids are not the values that kids oftentimes wind up taking away in terms of who are the most popular kids, what activities are valued. Historians of childhood have written about this as well. You know, the structural limitations of schools as are presently constructed, and why kids don't really seem to be in these schools for the reasons that adults, you know, want them to be in. And so my work, you know, in this particular study is focused on what adults can do to make the climate in a classroom, in a school, more positive, more conducive to learning.
Yeah, it's almost like seeing the classroom as an organism, I suppose, well, as another being.
The classroom is a society. The classroom is a micro society. So, you know, you look at our society, and I don't know if we're going to like what we see, but we see this faction, that faction. You see elements of unity. You see common values, but you also see that people's beliefs and people's behaviors vary tremendously depending upon where they are, who they hang out with, and the same does not hold as much for a classroom with 20 or 30 children, but it's a community. Mm. It's a social organism. It's a group where the group is more than just the sum of the kids who are in there.
Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting for us in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. My question is more or less is the study heading towards what I'm going to talk about. I was a single child. I'd like to know about that, you know, in relationship to other kids. But in particular, when there's remarriage and there's an amalgamation of different children from different, well, anything really, but the man has his children and the woman has her children. Are you headed in those directions too to see what kind of you know, magic comes out of that situation?
I can.
And secondly, I'm sort of, in a sense, looking for some uniqueness here. I was moved because of my mother's remarriage and stuff and job things 8 times in 3 years between 2 towns. It got to the place where one school system decided they would change the way they did things. They started the half of the book and finished at the end. For years, I never knew anything about Far Eastern Asia, Japan, or China because the geography text, when I showed up, I'd already had done that at the other school. Of course, it made me an A student easily enough. But I found some of that stuff remarkable. And then I talked to some buddies about, you know, that new kid you've got that came with your mother, and you know, what's things going on there. I wonder if you're interested in those dynamics eventually, and thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Who wants to jump in on that? There's a lot there.
Yeah, there was.
I can say something about the moving and relocation. The blended families, I know a bit, but of course would defer to Lori on that one. Actually, you know, 1 out of every 5 American families will move in a school year, and that doesn't count just the kids who are actually moving schools, but not necessarily because of an actual, you know, home relocation. And for a long time, we actually, the researchers, expected that these kinds of moves were extremely difficult and traumatic for kids, but that doesn't actually seem to be as clear in the support that we're seeing now as before, once you start looking at the other things going on in someone's life. So if a kid's, you know, move is related to their socioeconomic status, their parents' work, once you start sort of looking at those, then the move itself is actually more determined by the parents' outlook, and is this move good for us or is this move bad for us? Even if you move a lot, military families, you know, frequently move as much as every 2 years, and they actually do very well. So traditionally, the transition is only like 3 to 8 weeks long, and then after that, they sort of settle in. It's more difficult for kids in high school because they sort of have to rebuild that social capital on their own. They don't have a mommy saying, I'm going to make you new friends with a playgroup. They have to sort of figure it out on their own. So you have some problems there, but on the whole, I think people actually are doing much better in these relocation circumstances than they sort of think they are, including the caller, who I think sounded like he came out of it quite well.
Okay. Lori Kramer?
Let me talk a little bit about the remarried families, because I think that's a critical issue. You know, I think the caller is absolutely correct that this is a very stressful time for families, and in particular for the children from 2 different parents coming together expected to create a harmonious family together. We have pretty high expectations that the kids in the family are going to get along and find ways to relate to one another, when the reality is that you're bringing together some very unique people who have histories that may have involved some stress. You know, if these families are coming together because there had been a divorce or there had been a loss, a death in the family of a parent, or for whatever reason, you know, that could really be a disadvantage for some young people coming together. Sometimes the birth orders that kids have been in their families of origin change dramatically when they form this new remarried family, and that can really mix things up. Someone used to being the oldest in the family who's now a second or third born child in this new constellation can be awfully confused, and there can be some conflicts around those things as well. I don't think that we have really enough tools yet to help families deal with some of these issues, but we're learning more and more all the time, and I think this is certainly an area where parents want to think very carefully about what they can do to help kids get along under the circumstance and to develop some goals that are going to be realistic for their families.
And Phil Rodkin, what is the situation in that social community, the classroom, like for a child that's new to it, comes in the middle? Or
well, it's going to depend on what those child's unique strengths are. So if the kid is very athletic, very attractive, gregarious, then, you know, as Laurie implied, and as Ashley implied with transitions, they'll work their way in to the social network, just like most adults would. The issues are, what if no one sees, you know, what this child's unique strengths are? You know, who is it? You know, will it be a friend that the child makes? Will it be the teacher, you know, who brings out what those positive qualities are? That's going to be important, that a child doesn't come into a classroom on the outskirts, whether it's rejected or neglected, and not really a part of the activities that are taking place. For some kids, of course, just like for some adults, easier than others. And so for the kids for whom it doesn't seem so easy, so obvious, how will they be integrated? And is anyone in the school giving a thought to how that integration process would take place?
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. This afternoon, we're taking a look at some of the findings from The Surprising Science of Child Development. And our guests this afternoon are two faculty members from the University of Illinois, Laura Kramer and Philip Rodkin. Laura Kramer is an Associate Dean of Academic Programs and Professor of Applied Family Studies at the U of I. Phil Rodkin is an Associate Professor and Child Development Chair in Child Development at the College of Education. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. On the phone with us this afternoon is Ashley Merriman. She, together with Poe Bronson, wrote the book Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. The book contains lots of interesting information about the science of child development. And I'm going to pause here for just a moment. Kimberly Cronick is with me in the studio, with us in the studio this afternoon, because we're doing a pledge drive this afternoon, today, yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
That's
just
right.
A mini drive.
Yes.
And you are our outreach director for Illinois Public Media, and you do a lot of work with children.
Well, Molly Delaney, our educational outreach coordinator, works with kids before, you know, they get to school, so some of the age group you talked about. And then I work with a lot of middle school and high school kids, and I'm hearing a lot of what you're saying, stop, think, talk. And like, this applies to the young people that I work with. And my thought goes to, why isn't this taught in the schools? Why isn't it mandatory in the schools? I don't want listeners to miss any more of this interview.
Right.
So let me ask you to call in right now with your pledge and support this great kind of programming that you hear 5 days a week on our talk programs, news every day of the week. Now's the time to make a contribution to WILL at 217-244-9455. We want to hear from 250 people by tomorrow at the end of this mini drive. We have heard from 141
very
pledges.
Good.
That is wonderful. You can also pledge online, willpledge.org. And here's a special incentive to call today, right now. You can make a pledge. When you make a pledge of support right now, Common Ground Food Co-op is going to contribute the cost of 3 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So no matter what the size of your pledge, if you can make a $50 pledge or a $40 or $120 pledge, Whatever you call in right now and pledge, that will go, three meals from the Common Ground Food Co-op will go to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So it's another way of us being part of the community, providing information, providing support through partnerships. It's important to us. If it's important to you, call now, 217-244-9455, or you could go online, willpledge.org.
And that's the last time in this segment of the program that we're going to make that announcement. 244-9455, willpledge.org. Our thanks this afternoon to Kimberly Chronic. So, Lori told us about Stop, Talk, and Think. What kinds of strategies are you working with? Give us an example or two of something concrete that you're doing with teachers in classrooms to make that social community a healthier place.
Mm. Well, first we're trying to understand how well teachers themselves are aware of what the social networks in their classrooms are. Can they reproduce the friendships, the groups that kids, when we talk to them, say are present? You know, how do they deal, how do teachers deal with aggression and bullying in their classrooms? Do they ignore it? Do they just send kids to the principal's office? You know, or do they try and somehow intervene as quickly as they can in aggression, whether it's physical aggression or the relational aggression that Ashley was talking about at the outset of the program? But what we're doing with working with teachers is trying, number one, to help them understand what the social networks of their classroom are. You know, what are the potential points of conflict? Children who don't like one another, or great differences in power and status, where one child is bothering another child. To understand the events that are happening in the classroom within the context of the social community. So first, it's understanding that social community, and second is intervening in a way that will try and make pro-social behavior, academically oriented behavior, more positive. Still, part of what this research program is about is saying, well, you know, it's not simply the teacher who can command the, you know, atmosphere of the of children at will, but it's how the children are interacting with one another. So even how are they using instructional reading groups or seating assignments? How are children being organized in the classroom in ways that promote some kinds of relationships and makes other kinds of relationships more difficult? So that's the work that we're trying to do there, where it's awareness, intervention, and using strategies to promote cooperative learning and relationships that otherwise may not be possible in the class by bringing kids together.
Celeste, if I could jump in here
Sure.
for a second. I actually went to one of my great joys in being on the Science of Kids beat is that I go to conferences where the scientists are actually presenting their work that's in progress. And I went to one conference, and it was, you know, I wasn't even supposed to really be in the room. It was all the scientists just sort of talking together. And someone said, does anybody have any problem with their bullying program backfiring? And everyone in the room raised their hand. Every researcher working in the field who's tried an intervention is extremely wary of the fact that when you bring things straight into the classroom to the kid level, you know, Phil's all talking about, you know, how do we get the teachers to understand this? But when you start talking about this in the class to the kids, we may have problems that we don't anticipate. You know, most bullying is not done by that loner kid going, give me your lunch money. It's the popular kid who does as many pro-social behavior as they do aggressive behavior. But I've never once heard a principal brought parents into school and said, I'm sorry to tell you, your child's popular. It doesn't happen. So programs that target sort of emotional behavior in schools can often end up making things worse for the bully victim, because the popular kids, you know, what's a classic bullying prevention program is they go, raise your hand if you've been bullied. Tell me what that feels like. Well, the bully victim self-identifies. I'm someone you pick on, and this is what you do. It really bothers me. The popular kids look at each other and go, note to self, make sure when he's wearing green to tell him he looks like a leprechaun because he hates that. So we want to be really careful when we're bringing stuff into the class that we have really good research on exactly how this is going to work, the way we, not just the way we want it to work and the way we think it should work, but how it really does work. And that's why I think, you know, Phil's approach in terms of that teacher-focused and administrative kind of understanding patterns may be way more effective than actually saying, here's a handout on how to be nice to kids.
Right. Well, that's going to, I mean, things like that. I mean, I agree with what Ashley is saying. The, you know, pledges and so forth, you know, are not in and of themselves negative. But, you know, it is true, you know, again, going back to what James Coleman had said about the adolescent society, that the direction of that society wasn't the same direction that the adults who were building schools for them wished they would take. So, yeah, with bullying interventions, aggression interventions, there's an assumption, somewhere between an assumption and a hope, that kids will be receptive. There are whole school approaches to bullying where they say, well, part of this is making sure that all students are on board with this, which is never going to be the case because kids are rebellious. you know, and certainly many aggressive children, even if they're not widely liked in the classroom, are very popular. And have high social status. I mean, that's been a finding now that's been replicated 20, 30 times in independent research. I have a paper coming out with my colleague Glenn Roisman in the Department of Psychology, where this is coming out in a couple of months, where we looked at kids who are popular and aggressive in middle childhood, 4th through 6th grade, and in a well-known data set, the NICHD Early Study of Early Child Care, we asked, well, you know, what might differentiate these kids as being both popular and aggressive from kids who are aggressive but not popular, and other combinations. We said, you know, is it intelligence? Is it parenting? It wasn't these things. What it was time spent in childcare early in life, an extensive time in childcare, much more than kids who were aggressive, not popular, popular, not aggressive. That an extensive amount of time in peer contexts, especially peer contexts that are not well regulated, seems to naturally bring with it a connection between social status and aggression, getting what you want and the means for achieving it, that can endure for years. It was something that was pointed out, this connection between popularity and aggression, 30 years ago by one famous theorist, Yuri Bronfenbrenner, and that's been found since. So you leave kids to their own devices without any direction or guidance. And, of course, it depends on the kids that are involved. But don't be surprised if the children who have the highest social status are also among the most aggressive, whether or not they have pro-social behaviors that they show as well.
Very interesting. So what? Why do the kids hang with a bully?
Why are these popular kids also bullies?
Let's say you're Laurie Kramer, you're the most popular kid in my classroom, and I want to be your friend because you won't bully me if I'm in your good graces. What's going on?
There could be something about building alliances and coalitions for sure, but you know, I think we also have to realize that popularity is a two-edged sword in a sense. You know, kids who are popular, and I think Ashley and Poe point this out very well in the book. These are kids that are very socially skilled. They have a lot of social cognitive abilities. They're able to read social situations extremely well and to make good use of them. Now, whether they do this for good or for evil is another question, but they are learning, you know, the more social experiences that children have with one another, particularly when they are unregulated, as Phil says, you know, you run the risk of children using these abilities in ways that can be very hurtful. I know in siblings, we see it very, very early. You can see a 2.5-year-old figure out ways to drive his or her sibling crazy.
I mean, that's true.
And you also have that, the fact that, I mean, if you're 5 or 15 and your best friend is really good at insulting other people, that's kind of exciting, as long as you're not the target, right? And so that kind of, you know, it seems old. It's mature to, like, make somebody else feel like a schlump. But I've been thinking a lot about, you know, Phil's research and other work in popularity, and I I actually start thinking that it's not even about pro-social and aggressive as two separate things. I think oftentimes they're the same exact event. Mm-hmm. I mean, a girl can say to 50 kids, come over to my house, I have a pool, we'll have cake, and she's facilitating interactions and building camaraderie. Isn't that a pro-social event? Well, not to the 350 kids who didn't get invited. Mm-hmm. For them, it was exclusionary and hurtful. So I think, and sometimes those popular kids, you know, one researcher in Britain just said they're socially busy. They're just engaged, and they're doing good and bad all the time. And those things become exciting and become mature, and that's one of the reasons why they become such an object of focus.
Hmm. It is, at the same time, some of these aggressive children who also have moderate to actually very high levels of social status, they're really quite aggressive. They're very aggressive, and so while they have a constellation of behaviors and qualities that are skilled and unskilled, they are very aggressive. They're the top two or three aggressive kids in a classroom. So they're not just kids who are slightly kind of mean or a little bit above. Sometimes there's a sense, well, they're moderately aggressive, because of course if they were way aggressive, they couldn't be popular or have high social status, but yet they are.
Yeah, and one last question. We're going to have to wrap up here because we're at the end of the time. But what does good, regulated play childhood activities look like? I could give you about a minute and a half tops.
Good play is when kids are engaging in activities that they wouldn't, you know, and that they would normally engage in. In fantasy play and thinking about aspects of their social world that on their own they don't do. That's one.
And I think that in some ways adults in their world help children think about those social experiences in ways that will lead to some good adaptive outcomes.
One thing that's very interesting about play is that you take an activity, a behavior on kids by kids that seems so, you know, picayune, superfluous, unnecessary, trivial. But yet everyone from evolutionary psychologists to some of the great theorists, Vygotsky, Piaget, you know, have always pointed to children's play as a place where children can obtain what they want and what they need from their social environment in ways that are not possible in any other way. Lev Vygotsky said that children start to play when they realize that they can't get what they want in the immediate environment. So they go into a fantasy environment to get what they want. And that at some point, children, through play, learn that they don't need the world in front of them to achieve what they really want to achieve. It could be all up here, all in their head.
All in their head. Ashley, one last thought from you?
Well, I just always think of, you know, parents who wish their little kid would learn how to settle down. And I'm like, have you played hide and seek with that kid? Suddenly that kid who's running around screaming, you can't find them in the house, right? It's because they're not thinking about be quiet, be a good little girl, or be a good little boy. They're just invested in that thing that's exciting to them. And now suddenly they don't talk. Maybe there's a little giggle as you walk by. But I think we think of play as a time to blow off steam. But for kids, you know, what Laurie and Phil were saying, it's a time to do something where you're not conscious of yourself, but you're more focused on other things, and that's a really exciting and enriching experience for kids.
And there we'll leave it. I want to thank our guests this afternoon, Ashley Merriman, Laurie Kramer, and Phil Rodkin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.